The Pentagon and the rest of the national security establishment are scrambling. Just a couple of years ago, experts in artificial intelligence thought warfare-ready AI systems and autonomous weapons needed many more years of research. But the technology has shot ahead of schedule. China is well on the way to building a modern AI-enabled military and has announced its intention to be number one by 2030. Russia has already field-tested AI warfare in Syria and the Ukraine. Robert Work, co-chair of the congressionally mandated National Security Commission on AI, says without a surge in research now, the U.S. military could lose its edge in AI in 3 to 4 years.
Our AI has to be better than their AI. All you have to do is envision an AI-enabled cyber attack. And if their AI is better on offense than our AI is better on defense, that's going to be a bad day for us. This is our future now.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says it's not just a competition for battlefield dominance, but also one of values. And he promises a code of ethics to govern autonomous weapons.
We're going to compete to win, but we're going to do it the right way. We're not going to cut corners on safety, security, or ethics. And our watchwords are responsibility and results.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're going to talk about the new AI way of war. Well, you can imagine that any new AI weapon system will need a lot of testing. Testing after extensive development. So we spoke with a researcher who has helped the military develop autonomous weapons.
My name is Mikhail Rodriguez, and I'm the director of AI and autonomy at MITRE Labs. And I've had the honor of helping lead the Department of Defense's first AI red team. Red teaming involves having an exercise in which there's a deliberate team that is looking to break a system in order to reveal the different vulnerabilities. Really, the first time that it dawned on me the powerful effect that this could have in national security was when I was with a three-star general, and there was a pilot operating a simulation where they were being pitted against an AI system.
Getting shot, getting there.
And getting right down to the floor, banger down at 1,300 feet is going to really make Heron prove that they can do this gunshot at the floor, one of the most difficult things you can do in airborne execution in an F-16. We'll see if the AI is able to hack it.
And the pilot was very confident that he was going to win this dogfight, and only to realize that the AI was performing maneuvers that were incredibly counterintuitive, yet defeated that operator.
Looks like Heron's saddling up and with the kill.
And again, more of just that superhuman aiming ability that we're seeing out of Heron in this simulated environment, able to just follow that other airplane along, even through defensive types of maneuvers.
Absolutely amazing.
The general, who had also been an Air Force pilot, was looking at the screen. That's when I just saw it. It was just a look on his face. He said, it took a few minutes to say anything, I think. Up until recently, many of us were expecting very incremental, slow progress in the area of AI, which is why we were all really caught off guard and surprised when we suddenly saw this, you know, huge inflection point in AI systems around the year of 2014. It really kind of came as a confluence of two things. We had this widespread availability of training data for AI systems. And the other thing that came about was graphical processing units, were these chips that were made for video games and high-end video cards, turned out to be a perfect fit for the type of AI systems that were maturing at that time. So the confluence of these two things really created a kind of a Cambrian explosion, if you will. It was really around this time when I got a knock on my door, and it was a Marine colonel asking me to fly out to Silicon Valley to kickstart the Department of Defense's Pathfinder program to operationalize this new wave of AI. And this program was called Project Maven. And I have to say, it was really fascinating. And in many ways, I felt like I needed to be bilingual as part of this project. And on the one hand, we had on one side of the room, we had, you know, three-star generals. And then on the other side, we had AI engineers in hoodies from Silicon Valley. And while they had a common goal to think creatively of how AI can improve the safety and well-being of our country. In many ways, they were also speaking different languages. My first experience in red teaming a DoD AI system involved a drone that was able to automatically recognize objects in the scene. And what we demonstrated was that with a simple piece of paper that we put on the ground, we were able to essentially jam the AI system in such that it became very confused, and in some cases automatically landed because they weren't able to recognize the scene. Because you see, it turns out that there's these strange behaviors of current modern AI systems that they're susceptible to something called adversarial patterns. And these are essentially kind of like catnip for the AI system. It just gets very attracted to these patterns. And then you could essentially jam an AI system without really knowing much about it. In many ways, there's both, you know, a lot of excitement in the field of AI, but there's also some amount of anguish. And many of us feel like we're kind of operating on alien technology. What we're really seeing is that we're kind of in the era of alchemy when it comes to AI, in the sense that it works, but we don't really understand why.
That was Mikael Rodriguez, the director of AI and autonomy at the federally funded MITRE Labs. Well, let's learn a little bit more about what AI and autonomous weaponry actually mean when it comes to the world's great superpowers. So joining me now from Washington is Patrick Tucker, technology editor for Defense One. He's been covering AI for the past 15 years, and we have links to some of his terrific reporting at onpointradio.org. Patrick, welcome.
Hey, Megan, thanks for having me.
Also with us is General John Murray. He's with us from Austin, Texas. He is the first commanding general of the United States Army Futures Command, or AFC. General Murray, welcome to you.
Thanks, Megan. It's good to be on also with Patrick.
So, General, let me start with you. Given where military AI technology and weapon systems, the directions they're headed, can you paint a picture to us, describe what could be going on the battlefield when the U.S. or China or Russia are fully AI?
So, Magna, I mean, that's a pretty broad question. I think there's all kinds of directions I could go with that. when I think about the future, and it's really not future because artificial intelligence is here today, just like robotics and autonomy. But I think really in a couple different applications, one would be what I just mentioned, the ability to do unmanned teaming. And we've got some instances that we're exploring right now and experimenting with in terms of air and ground systems to be able to communicate and really figure things out on their own to collect the data we're after. And then I also think about the amount of information that's available to commanders on a battlefield today. And that's only going to grow. And so the ability for really machines and algorithms to sift through massive amounts of data and information and provide future commanders with recommendations on the best way forward for whatever situation they're in.
So recommendations there, because what it seems to me are the singular advantages of artificial intelligence and machine learning is the ability, as you said, to process complex data much, much faster than human beings can. And then, in fact, given sort of parameters that they're programmed with, make decisions. So do you see AI systems as making certain decisions on the battlefield in the future?
What I see is AI systems helping commanders make the best decisions. And so, and I think the SecDef said this, we don't believe we're in a position where we have to choose between artificial intelligence and really the ethics that I'm sure is part of the discussion here in terms of machines making decisions. I think it really depends. In the DoD policy is that we will always have a human in the loop. The thing that does concern me, and I've said this in other forums, is, and I think the debate that you're teeing up today is absolutely a critical debate. And I would almost guarantee that some of the places you mentioned and others, that this debate is not going on. And so People ask me, will AI come to a battlefield? It will absolutely come to a battlefield in the future. And we're going to have to keep pace and deal within the ethics that I think is actually a strength of the United States and other countries to keep pace with our adversaries.
Yeah, so that is part of the discussion that we're going to be having today, because there's no doubt, Patrick, let me turn to you, that AI-integrated militaries are coming. And in fact, as I just briefly mentioned at the top of the show, China has declared as much, and Russia has, in fact, even tested some AI systems in Syria and Ukraine. Can you tell us about that?
Right. So Russia and China, they are both very ambitious in terms of bringing AI into operations in Ukraine. If you go back to 2014, you see some of the first uses of small drones for intelligence collection. And these were human guided, but they were performing something that drones had never done before. These are little drones, and they were finding enemy positions, enemy tank positions, and reporting that information back to allow much faster action against those positions. So the Russians were basically able to take out entire like battalion in a fraction of the time that it would normally take. Those were human guided, but they've since developed new drones that can operate much more autonomously, collecting that targeting information, sending it back. In Syria, there were some incidents of ground robots that may have had varying levels of autonomy. And importantly, when Russia makes announcements about this stuff, if it's not independently verified, you have to be very careful, because deception is a huge part of their the way they do warfare. But take that 2014 example in Ukraine, and then look to, for instance, Israel and the Gaza conflict at the end of June, where Israelis were able to deploy an autonomous drone swarm for targeting. It's still humans that took the shot, but it's leagues above where it was just in 2014.
Wow. So when we come back, we're going to talk more about where AI is now, where it could be in a couple of years, and who's going to take the lead in this international competition when it comes to AI military readiness. So Patrick Tucker and General Murray, stand by. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're talking this hour about the near future of AI-enabled or even AI-integrated military superpowers. I'm joined today by General John Murray. He's the first commander of the U.S. Army Futures Command. Patrick Tucker joins us as well. He's technology editor at Defense One. And Patrick, I wonder if you could actually give us a little bit more detail about the things we might see in the next couple of years, because what we've already understood is that AI can help, can make things happen faster. It can actually make some decisions, but give us a scenario. Like, what if a missile is headed towards a base at high speed and there are only seconds to react? What could an AI-enabled military do to defend against that?
The specific scenario you're talking about, if you take a base and instead apply it to a ship, there is already autonomous ship defense using a system called Phalanx that's actually been around for, I think, 2 decades now. And that sees an incoming threat, makes a determination with radar, and then takes it out. But when you're talking about something at sea, there's very little possibility that there's a human on board. So that's like ship defense that doesn't have a lot of ethical considerations to it. What you're really going to see, I think, in the next few years is an effort in exercises across a variety of different militaries, but certainly in the U.S., to much better integrate all of the data that's on the battlefield. Could be coming from drones, could be coming from satellites, it might be soldier-borne sensors, it might be from the open internet. Integrating that into one place and then running AI on it in order to process it so that you immediately get a sense of all of the potential targets on the battlefield and what is the best weapon to take them out. And then if you lose a jet or you lose a drone, immediate adaptation to that new battlefield reality. So it is very much what you just described in terms of acceleration, but it's across the entire battlefield. And it sort of works the same way that Facebook or Google seems to kind of know what you're going to want to buy before you can buy it. If you're in the market for a new bed frame, for instance, or paper towels, they're able to put that ad in front of you in just the right place. Apply that to an entire theater of war. And that's the effect that you're going for here when you apply AI, not just at the individual platform level, like drones or specific like robot tanks or something like that, but at the strategic level, it's that acceleration that really enables dominance.
So General Murray, this seamlessly integrated, instantly communicating, rapid information processing across a multitude of assets sounds like it would be very, very hard to defend against.
Well, yeah. And before I get there, though, Magna, is Patrick has made some excellent points the last couple minutes. So he talked about the proliferation of sensors, you know, and as I think about the future, and it's not the deep future, is everything becomes a sensor, which he said. And you also, the example you use in terms of an inbound missile with seconds to make a decision. He also said in the Ukraine, which we studied very closely, that a human on the trigger when making lethal decisions. So I think this is the nuances of the discussion. You know, where is a human required to make the decision? If you've got seconds to make a decision and it's a missile or a rocket or a drone swarm, does there, and I'm not saying there needs to be or there doesn't need to be, but does there need to be a human on the loop or in the loop for that? And then the other thing I'd say is, you know, the scenario that Patrick described involves, and what we're talking about is moving massive amounts of data. And where we're different from Google or anybody else is that we're going to be operating in an environment where our adversaries are going to be trying to take the ability to move data away from us. So we call it a degraded or denied environment primarily from a non-lethal electronic warfare type standpoint. And so that just makes our problem that much more difficult. I clearly see the advantages of what Patrick is talking about. And matter of fact, we're working on the ability to really harness massive amounts of and make sense of the data to enable faster decisions. Because as I look, even in the near future, the ability to understand first, to decide first and to act faster than your potential opponent or your opponent is going to be a critical advantage on a future battlefield.
So your point, General Murray, is very, very well taken, because I had been focusing quite deliberately on sort of the hot war aspects of AI applications for national security. But of course, those aren't the only ones. I mean, you pointed out like dominance of information and movement of information. There's financial markets. There's, how AI could hopefully positively or even negatively impact climate change as a national security issue, future pandemics. I mean, this is the thing about artificial intelligence that is so gripping. It does have the power to transform society broadly, right? to transform civilization, which is what makes it such an urgent national security question. So, General Murray and Patrick Tucker, if you could both just hang on here for a second, that is the perfect segue to a conversation I had a couple of days ago. Now, in 2018, Congress formed the Independent National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence, giving it a mandate to investigate and report to Congress how the United States should, quote, advance artificial intelligence and machine learning for national security writ large. Now, in March of this year, the commission released its final report to what I would say is surprisingly little fanfare, and surprising because the report makes it clear that, quote, for the first time since World War II, America's technological predominance, the backbone of its economic and military power, is under threat due to international advances in AI. And then the commission also adds global crisis crises exemplified by the COVID-19 pandemic and climate change highlight the need to expand our conception of national security. So then there's this. It's the part that I find the most remarkable. The commission intimates that decision makers in the U.S. may not even fully comprehend the changes AI will bring because the report begins with what Thomas Edison said about electricity so long ago. That, quote, "It is a field of fields. It holds the secrets which will reorganize the life of the world." And they say that encapsulates the AI future. So, given all that, I recently spoke with Gilman Louie, a member of the National Security Commission on AI and a former CEO of InQtel, the government's national security venture capital arm, and I began by asking Mr. Louie to describe what might the future look like if the U.S. doesn't surge ahead in the AI race.
You can see a world down the future where AI is used to empower systems that are fundamentally authoritarian in nature, right? The collection of data, the analytics of the data, the ability to then limit individual choice and independent decision-making that takes away what we consider to be free will.
Yeah, and what's clear in the commission's report is that you and your fellow commissioners see this as a competition, and the chief competitor is China.
A country like China has what we call military-civil fusion, which is fundamentally saying to the civilian companies, right, that your responsibility as a Chinese company is to the government and to Chinese national defense above that of commercial interests. And so there's challenges on that side. And the other side of that is, you know, on areas of national security, cybersecurity. Can you imagine a system where their systems are just smarter than our systems? Their offensive ability to come in and take information at will from your computer systems is smarter than your ability to defend it, or that their weapon systems can hit you with a level of precision and you cannot guarantee your ability to defend against it. Or a financial marketplace that is driven by authoritarian governments that may be tempted to manipulate financial markets at a global scale to suit their advantage. You know, so those are the dark, dark outcomes.
Do you think any sector of the United States, and I'll throw in any branch of the government at any level, is fully ready right now for the changes that could come within even 5 or 10 years?
I do not think we as a government are fully prepared in its impact on how we think about government. I mean, to use these technologies, it's not simply a matter of turning on Siri or some version of a computer assistant. It has to be incorporated in our everyday workflows, how we think about our work, how we think about information. And until we get that level of training and concepts of operations down, we're still in those very early days. If this was compared to the era of airplanes, right? AI has clearly passed the Wright brothers phase, where we're probably still in the biplane phase, you know, kind of the 1917 era of aircraft and aircraft design. It's kind of where we are in AI. So for us to imagine modern systems around jets and supersonic and hypersonic aircraft, it would be like science fiction. I think the same thing is true with AI at this particular point.
If I can just stretch your analogy a little bit here for a second, because I think it's a really interesting one. Okay, so if we're in the 1917 era of AI right now, maybe the next step to think about isn't necessarily supersonic aircraft, but what happened a mere 22 years later in 1939, right? The leap of technology between the end of the First World War and the beginning of the Second was tremendous. Aircraft were far more sophisticated, and it doesn't have to be supersonic jets that we're worried about, but even just the next step in AI that could come 10 or 15 years from now.
Or even earlier, right? I mean, back in 1917, who can imagine a fragile piece of machinery like an airplane could sink a battleship.
Or drop a nuclear bomb.
All that is true, and it is true on the AI side.
Finally, if I could, I cannot get away from what I think is one of the fundamental questions here. do human beings have the mental capacity to make the right decisions, to make good decisions for their fellow human beings in the face of these civilization transforming technologies? I mean, I'll go back to Edison, where your report starts, and the quote I read, where Edison, talking about electricity back then, was saying, it holds the secrets which will reorganize the life of the world. And then in the report, you and your fellow commissioners write, Edison's astounding assessment came from humility. I mean, it doesn't seem to me as if humanity has approached really quantum leap changes in technology before, anything from splitting the atom to decoding DNA to even something as commonplace now as automated trading on the stock market. We just don't approach these things with the required humility to accomplish everything you've written in the report. So why would that change now? Where will this humility come from?
You know, I have great faith, you know, and just the way we treat open societies, right? Particularly in areas like scientific discoveries, that open is generally better than closed, right? The pandemic, we were able to deal with the pandemic because nations around the world put all their national resources in on getting to a vaccine. And we ended up with multiple vaccines in the period of time unheard of in mankind. And we used machine learning and computation and data sciences to get us there. I'm hoping that we will continue to have the forces of good outweigh the forces of evil. I also believe in governments, responsible governments around the world cannot take it for granted, and that we need to be proactive in how we think about these problems. And we need to make sure that there is an alternative safety valve whenever we create these technologies and use it, particularly in ways that we don't necessarily fully understand. But nevertheless, as you said, we are today in a better world because of electricity. Even though there were capabilities that you could use electricity for harm. I think the same thing is true with AI, I think. But it's up to humans, right? This technology, this series of technologies are amplifiers. They'll amplify good and they will amplify bad. And it is up to us as a country, as a democracy, to present and develop technologies which protect as well as encourage us to use our imagination for positive uses and not just to operate out of fear.
Gilman Louie, he's a member of the National Security Commission on AI, the congressionally mandated National Security Commission on AI. So, Patrick Tucker at Defense One, let me first turn to you. You want to respond to what you heard Gilman Louie say there. What do you think?
I completely agree. This is an area where I think a lot of people, both citizens and to a certain extent lawmakers, or they're trying to get hip to it, don't appreciate the degree to which AI is going to affect the lives of citizens and also the potential vulnerabilities that our system has, economic system, as well as, you know, just our social structure has, to damage that could be accomplished by an adversary using just even very regular AI tools. You brought up cybersecurity at the top of the discussion. I think that that's a really good point. If you talk to people that are working, for instance, at the NSA, and you say, what effect is AI going to have on the future of cybersecurity? They'll tell you that what you're not going to get is really smart AI that's going to crack super hard encryption and hit the really hard targets and outperform like the best human tailored access operators. That's not what you get. What you get is AI that can find all of the vulnerabilities in operating systems that are sitting on computers at energy companies and hospitals and schools. Basically, computers that are running old software, finding those vulnerabilities where they are and then figuring out what is the best possible exploit based on stuff that's already been published to hit those systems. And that causes massive disruption. So it's actually hitting the easy targets. And that should be kind of frustrating because that's something that we could defend against today with just a little bit of will. But in many ways, because we're not having a discussion, for instance, about cybersecurity at that level, we're vulnerable to the effects of AI on that same problem.
General Murray, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. So, and I actually agree with most, both Mr. Louie and Patrick on this one. And I think the thing I would emphasize for both is we have a choice. This nation has a choice, and we control our own destiny. You mentioned the investment, and it's really the investments that China is making. Mr. Louie mentioned the closed society versus open society, and there are advantages to that civ-mil fusion that he talked about, civilian-military fusion that he talked about. There's also disadvantages. There's advantages to our system. And what I really found fascinating was the interwar period between World War I and World War II, and it was, in my view, it was much more than just the advancement of the airplane. So if you look at the Germans at the beginning of World War II, the significant advantage they had was really combining technologies, not a single technology called the airplane. It was the ability to really link airplanes with ground tanks, in this case, through a radio. So it was the combinations of those technologies that gave them that significant advantage. And I think that's true going forward, not only artificial intelligence, but also autonomy and robotics.
Well, we have to take a quick break. When we'll come back, we're going to hit this question of ethical use of AI in the military. So stand by, everyone. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the coming future of an AI way of war. And I'm joined today by General John Murray. He's first commander of the U.S. Army Futures Command. Patrick Tucker joins us as well. He's technology editor at Defense One. So now we are landing at that question of how do you do AI warfare ethically, given the immense power that automated systems and AI-integrated militaries could potentially have. So let's listen to what the United States Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, said in a speech at the Global Emerging Technology Summit earlier this very month. He vowed that while the U.S. would compete to win in the field of AI, it would not, quote, cut corners on safety, security, or ethics.
Our development, deployment, and use of AI must always be responsible, equitable, traceable, reliable, and governable. And we're going to use AI for clearly defined purposes. And we're not going to put up with unintended bias from AI. We're going to watch out for unintended consequences. And we're going to immediately adjust, improve, or even disable AI systems that aren't behaving the way that we intend.
Well, we asked Gilman Louie, you heard from him a little bit ago, from the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence, we asked him to comment about how to achieve that ethical use of AI so that the systems are not used, as the Secretary of Defense said, in unintended ways. And here's a little bit of what Gilman Louie told us.
Human responsibility cannot be passed to a machine. But humans make the decision of when to deploy these systems and when not to deploy these systems. What are the boundaries in which these systems are designed to operate in? All of those should meet the highest standards of ethical considerations that is currently framed in the IHL and other forms of bilateral and multilateral agreements that we have around the world.
Well, joining us now is Heather Roth. She's a philosopher and political scientist. She wrote the Department of Defense's AI Ethics Principles. She's also a fellow at the Brookings Institution and an associate fellow at Cambridge University's Center for the Future of Intelligence. And she joins us from Phoenix, Arizona. Heather Roth, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
I wonder first if I could ask you if we are already seeing evidence of a lack of ethical restraint in the use of AI on the battlefield. And I'm thinking about what Patrick had said earlier, that the Russians actually field tested AI systems in places like Ukraine and Syria in an actual, you know, hot scene with real lives and real people at stake. That's already happened. So is this question of international agreements on the ethical use of AI already moot?
I wouldn't say that it's moot. The international community has been debating the question of at least autonomous weapon systems since 2014, 2015. The United States' Department of Defense came out with its own policy on autonomous weapon systems in 2012, which unfortunately, General Murray, I must disagree with you, does not state that a human will always be in the loop. That's DoD policy directive 3000.09. But these questions of what the international norm setting standard is still developing. And I should note, too, that autonomy and AI tend to be used interchangeably. And I think we might want to keep some of those discussions slightly separate, given the breadth of AI applications. So,
Okay, but can I just stop you there, Heather? Because I appreciate the specificity here, and I want to have the most relevant conversation possible. So what term should we be using? Should we be using autonomy in the context of this conversation or AI?
Well, I think it's whether or not what ethical questions you want to raise, right? So if we're talking about the hot wars and the pointy end of the stick, you're going to be talking about physical systems and non-physical systems in the cyber realm. Those can be AI enabled. But if you're going to talk about, you know, AI systems that are back office or have to do with personnel or with different types of decision aids and things of that nature, those have kind of longer term, longer tail effects that are still important, but they're not the hot war stuff that everybody kind of puts their attention to. But they still have wide ranging ethical implications for morale and for the way we fight and the way we train.
Okay, point taken. Now, you had just also said something which I want to get a little bit more from you and then get the general to respond, because this does seem to be a central precept in how we might achieve ethical uses of AI, that a human decision maker would always be in the loop. So can you just clarify a little bit? What is the policy?
Yeah, the policy right now, so the policy is 3000.09, and that's the policy around autonomous weapon systems and semi-autonomous weapon systems within the DoD. That policy outlines the types of permissions required to seek a major acquisitions defense program. And there are some special permissions that need to be in place to move forward on acquiring autonomous weapon systems. It does not, however, state that a human needs to be in the loop for those. By definition, an autonomous weapon system is a system that can select and engage targets without intervention by a human operator. The question, if you want to think of it as a human's always aware, well, that's true. But if you're thinking about the very action of selecting and engaging targets, humans aren't going to be in those decisions or those, I wouldn't want to call them decisions at that level, but they're not going to be in that tight, find, hunt, fix, track, engage targets. But there will be a human commander stating, this is the type of, you know, targeting plan that I have. These are the effects that I want to achieve. These are the munitions that I have. So if you think of this as an entire command and control chain, then of course there's humans there. But in that tighter loop, the autonomous weapon system is not going to have a human in that.
Right. And I mean, the tighter loop by definition is one of the advantages of AI, right? So General Murray, would you like to respond to that?
No, I appreciate the correction on the policy, although I must also slightly disagree, right? So I think it goes back to the discussion we had earlier, you know, whether you're talking, and I'm sure she'll disagree to this too, but whether you're making a lethal decision or a non-lethal decision. And I just, you know, so we're working on things right now that does a lot of what she's talking about in terms of target identification, target selection. But at the point that a trigger gets pulled on a lethal decision, we're working towards having a human in the loop. And I think that goes back to that ethical piece of artificial intelligence. The policy may be exactly as she states, but that's not the direction the Army is going. We intend to, when it comes time for a lethal decision and pulling the trigger, as she said, we're working towards artificial intelligence that does everything short of that and then allows a human to make that final decision. You know, and I'll just, my experience growing up in the Army, I'll take you inside of a tank behind the gunner's seat, for instance, is we trained our gunners using flashcards just like I learned my math tables growing up. And I forget exactly what a young man or woman would have to score on these flashcards to get permission to pull that trigger. But I can't imagine an automated target recognition system not doing a better job than human memory can do in terms of recognizing exactly what that is that's in the sights of that tank. And then allowing a human to make the decision on pull the trigger or not. And I actually think that makes us, in some cases, in some ways, safer to the use of artificial intelligence.
Can you just clarify for a second here, General? Because I want to be sure I understand. So you said that you can't imagine an automated system not doing a better job than a human soldier in the tank?
So it's been a number of years, but I think back, let's say you had to have a 90% success rate, which is pretty good on the flashcards to qualify to sit in that gunner seat. With the right training data and the right training, I can't imagine not being able to get a system, an algorithm to be able to do better than 90% in terms of saying this is the type of vehicle that you're looking at and then allowing that human to make that decision on whether the machine is right or not and to pull the trigger.
I see. Okay. So the automated system would do better in target identification. The human would make the decision to pull the trigger. But Patrick Tucker, let me turn back to you and then Heather Roth, I'll hear from you as well. The scenario that General Murray just described, okay, that makes sense that a human would be in the loop by definition. But the scenarios you were talking about earlier about, fully connected, fully integrated, entire systems, not just one tank, but drones, airplanes, tanks, even information coming from soldiers on the ground or systems going into places where we, by definition, don't have any. We don't have any boots on the ground because we don't want them there for their own safety. Can we maintain humans in the loop for those scenarios?
Well, I mean, let's hope so. This is the really hard problem of warfare in the next couple of, the next era of warfare is that we're going to be planning and training against adversaries that are able to knock out communications in many contexts. They're going to be able to disrupt the way all of those systems are talking to one another, or at very least make it much more difficult. And so the challenge is actually keeping some lines of communication open or finding new ones in the face of an adversary like China or Russia that can contest exactly that networking principle. And so that's the real challenge, right? Like, how do you find areas, for instance, of the electromagnetic spectrum where you can actually communicate small bits of information, maybe not as much as you would like, but do so in order to maintain some degree of human control or at very least like real intelligence exchange? That's a huge problem. It's a huge challenge. We know that network warfare is going to be a lot faster, that it's kind of the key to dominance, but we also know that the network is the first thing a very smart and very capable adversary is going to attack. And so that becomes exactly the issue of how to do that.
Right. So, Heather Roth, I feel like perhaps this is my lack of experience here, but I'm suffering from a little bit of cognitive dissonance between the advantages that autonomous and ultra-fast systems that can process huge amounts of information much faster than human beings, the advantages that those give us, while also trying to maintain humans in critical parts of the decision loops, because it seems to me that AI makes that decision window just way too small for humans to countermand the very choices that the AI systems might be making.
Thanks, Magna. Yeah, I think you bring up a really great point. So one of the things about the AI ethics principles that the DoD adopted, and one of the things that I think sometimes gets overlooked is that, you know, when we're talking about AI ethics, we're not talking about a single point in time. And so, you know, it's not that I can build a system and then I never have to check on it again. You know, the ethics box is checked. There, what we're thinking about here is, you know, responsible innovation and responsible design. So understanding that there may be things like automation bias where humans think, oh, the system's going to be so great, I should just say yes to it all the time, which kind of downplays the notion of human responsibility, right? When you're cognitively just almost an automaton at that point. And so really designing systems on the very front side to take into consideration what the human operator needs in terms of the information flows, in terms of the tempo, in terms of the graphical designs and the user interfaces, as well as then when they're deployed, and if there's any sort of upgrades or updates that these systems have, or if they're continuing to learn and continuing to do life cycle testing to ensure that their behaviors are in bound. So sustainment becomes a huge question for ethics as well. And then really thinking about what Patrick said and saying that these are network systems. And so we actually have to not just test and verify and validate the single entity, but we also have to test in some senses the system of systems so that we can understand how humans are interacting, where the information lags are, where the interdependencies are, and so that we can see, you know, humans are making quote unquote the right decision, the decision we want, we're training them in the right way, and that we're continually addressing and evaluating how we're using these systems when they're deployed. Because the other thing too is that even if these systems are continually lifecycle tested and evaluated, armies and navies and air forces, they adapt. And so, you know, you have to think about how a system designed for one use, you know, if it's going to be repurposed, is that repurposing going to be unethical? Or what are the types of risks involved of using a system that was considered on label for one mission and might be considered off label for another? And so a lot of more information is going to be required in terms of the training data, in terms of what the mission scope is, in terms of what the capability set is. What happens when you start merging those with other types of systems, as the general alluded to before with the interwar period? You know, if you're combining different types of capabilities, you get this emergent property that you really need to be mindful of as you go forward. And I'll also note for fun fact, right, you know, when you think about World War II, you know, the first autonomous weapon was deployed in World War II, right? That was the V-1 rocket. And right. So the autonomy in the space here isn't new. We've had autonomous systems for quite some time, and we've even had AI systems for quite some time. The difference, I would state, is in this adaptation and learning at scale. And where those emergent properties are.
So, Heather, if I can just jump in here, we're quickly running out of time. We've got under a minute here, maybe even 30 seconds. And I just want to touch on the fact that it seems like international agreements have to be part of this near future. Is the UN trying to establish some kind of international norms for AI warfare? And are China and Russia even interested?
They are trying to come up with some norms. They have stated that human control is necessary, and so they are moving towards that. But China has been rather obsequious in what they want, and Russia has been rather not very helpful. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Well, with that, I am just afraid we're flat out of time. We could have gone on for so much longer. So, Heather Roth, philosopher and political scientist who wrote the Department of Defense's AI Ethics Principles, thank you so much for joining us. And General John Murray, first commander of the U.S. Army's Futures Command, thank you as well. And Patrick Tucker, technology editor at Defense One, thank you. This is On Point.